Hey guys, today's episode is brought to you by PrettyRiot.com. PrettyRiot.com is a Houston-based blog that caters to music, art, fashion, and almost anything independent. Naturally drawn to the unbeaten path, Pretty Riot's goal is to shine some light on all the badass stuff you have to search for. They're in love with art and artists of all types, so they created this site as a platform to showcase these things to the world. You should definitely be on PrettyRiot.com. Okay? Now let's get down.
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Maldi.
All right. Hello. Welcome to the show. I'm Johnny. I'm your host. This is How Did I Get Here? I interview people. I know we've got a lot of new listeners. I'd like to welcome you all to the show. We've got a good show for you today. I have a great guest. But before I get to that, I'll tell you that it is the week before Christmas. And I'm off from Skyrocket for a couple of weeks, which is nice. Get a little break from shows. And just kind of like, I know right now it seems like a good thing, but I bet Friday night at about 9 o'clock I'm going to start feeling weird, which is what happens to me. And Saturday night I'm going to feel weird. And then I'll be visiting my family for Christmas in Houston. Should be fun, right? Maybe you're going to be traveling. Maybe you're listening to this while you're traveling. Good luck with that. Anyway, I've got some more shopping to do. I was coming back this weekend from the shows. I realized I've got a lot more shopping to do. I thought I'd kind of done it because I did this blanket present for my family, but I realized that I still have a lot more gifts I have to get, and so I'm making a list. I'm checking it twice, and my guest today is Lance Keltner. He's an amazing guitarist, songwriter, musician. He's been around for a while. He has run the gamut. He's put out in independent records, major label records, toured the States, done Europe, been a sideman, frontman, the whole thing. Now he's doing this really cool thing where he reps gear, high-end gear, and he demos it on videos that you can see on YouTube. You can look it up on YouTube, look up Lance Keltner. You can find all this gear that he has. It's really amazing stuff, and he's very, very cool, very entertaining. And I've known him for a long time. I never really got a chance to sit down and really talk to him and find out who he is until we did this. So he came over a couple weeks ago. I'd like to thank my friend Bevis Griffin for setting this up for us. And I finally got to sit down and talk to Lance Keltner. And I had a great time. And it's a great conversation. He's really funny. He tells great stories. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here's my guest, Lance Keltner. Let's get down. Your last instrumental album?
Yeah, that's that song is called The Last Goodbye, and it's on my album, which is called Mystic Redneck.
Right. What is that? I've always kind of gotten that vibe from you.
Yeah.
I'll be honest.
Yeah, well,
not in a bad way.
No, I mean, it's like, you know, I've been to India three times, and, you know, I'm a seeker of truth, but then I will kick your ass after a few beers if you piss me off.
I like that.
So, yeah, that's kind of it. Yeah.
To me, that's a real person. It's too hard to believe someone that's just walking around a little too grounded.
Pious.
Quiet, pious. Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, because you know they've got some room in the back of their house with a swing and all kinds of weird stuff going on back
there. Yeah. So who played on Mystic Redneck?
Well, it was funny enough. It's like the last few years, one of the things I've been doing for a living, Johnny, is doing product demo videos for high-end guitar and amp companies.
Yeah.
And Mystic Redneck actually, for the most part, the live stuff you hear with the band was done with Tommy Taylor on drums for the most part. There's a few songs on the record that were Frosty Smith.
Oh, wow.
Mark Epstein played all the bass stuff, and he's great. Mark hasn't lived in Austin that long, but he used to play with Johnny Winter and Joe Bonamassa. He's a great, great bass player. And then some of the stuff that has keyboards, Patterson Barrett played keys on some of the stuff. And then,
he was around a long time ago. I remember him when I lived here, when my mom was alive, like in the 80s, but then I didn't really see him after that.
Yeah.
Well,
Patterson got into more of an Americana thing,
uh-huh.
And so he kind of quit playing with a lot of bands around here, and he does a lot of work with the Americana scene and goes to Nashville once a year, and pardon me, and he does a lot of work with those people, so we don't see him out in the clubs as much anymore.
Right.
But he's a tremendous musician. He plays keys and guitar and you know everything. I mean, the guy's unbelievable.
And they used to call him Doc Patterson.
Yeah, he was called Doc when he was with the Austin All Stars.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But, some weird random teenage memory I have.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was him. And so he played some on that record as well. The song you were just hearing was called The Last Goodbye, which I did all that by myself. That was programmed drums on that tune, and I played all the keys and guitars and everything. And just one of those, you know, I'm sure you've had it as a songwriter, it just kind of happened in the middle of the night, and I just finished it all in like 2 or 3 hours, and it was done. And, you know, that's probably one of my favorite songs I've ever done, just because of one of those few moments that I listen back to my own guitar play and go, wow, that was pretty good. Yeah.
I had this conversation with David Grissom. There's a focus that you probably have on guitar that I don't, and Grissom as well, that really you're driven and you're constantly striving for this thing that you're always working on. And I bet both of you guys are like the same kind of like kind of harsh critic of yourselves. And
right.
And do you find, I'm trying to formulate this question in the right way. Mm-hmm. Is it daunting? Or
yeah.
do you compare yourself to other guitar players, or do you do that?
I don't. And I did for years when I was coming up, you know, and I look back on the 80s in Austin and it was like,
Yeah.
I was a wasted cause in the 80s, because not only did I, you know, I look back on it now and I go, okay, not only was I insecure about what I was doing anyway, I was one of the only people that was in a hair band doing hair metal, and all the other bands were making fun of us until they found out all the girls were coming to the shows. And,
yeah.
then, they were going, and then they'd go, so how do you put that eyeliner on? I'd go, come here, I'll show you. You know, and then, you know, I remember like, you know, Charlie Sexton, you know, would come to our shows with Wayne Nagel, and he looked like a 50s sort of thing.
Right.
And I remember one particular night, Charlie came back and he goes, dude, he goes, that was fun. He goes, but I'm never going to look like that, man. That's crazy.
Sure enough.
In the next year. Boom, you know, but yeah, so I guess, you know, the long answer to the short question is that, somewhere along the line, I decided that I'm only who I am, and I can't be anybody else, or I can't strive to be anybody else.
Right.
And when you have friends like David Grissom, and like Eric Johnson's a dear friend of mine, it's like there's no sense in even trying to compare yourself to people like that. You know, you can just be the best you can be. And once I got into that mindset, I actually was a lot more creative and did better music anyway, because I wasn't chasing anyone else's guitar sound or anybody else's talent. I just realized, hey, man, some people think faster than I do, and that's just going to be what's going to happen, and I have a whole different way of approaching things, and it's just what I was born with. You know, so you develop what you can, and what you can't develop, you just give up on. You know, that's what I do. I go, I'm not going to be David Grissom. I'm not going to be Eric Johnson. I'm just going to do what I do, right?
Right. So you started playing when you were 10.
Yeah.
What inspired what was the tipping point that made you a guitar guy?
It's a very strange, like, it's a story that like somebody might have made up in the 70s, but it's true. I wanted to be an airborne ranger. I had no interest in music, zero interest in music.
Like, a paratrooper guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
So when I was six, seven years old, I decided I'm going to be an airborne ranger.
Right.
I'm going to be a colonel in the airborne, and I'm going to have a career in the Army. I'm going to retire after 30 years and then teach people to do covert military things, you know? And so
a Green Beret kind of guy.
Green Beret kind of.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to be, right? And so when I'm, the true story, when I was 10 years old, I had a horrible fever and I almost died. So back then, you know, redneck Texas mothers, they didn't take you to the hospital or the ER. She ran across the street to this nurse that lived across the street and said, he's got 104 temperature, it won't come down. And she said, give him this. And what she gave my mom was a bottle of phenobarbital. and heavy narcotic
yeah.
for a 10-year-old. So she gave me the phenobarbital, 2 spoonfuls of that, and I literally tripped my brains out for like 8 or 9 hours. I remember the whole thing very vividly. And it, during this time, I pictured myself as a younger, or as an older young adult playing in a with a rock band. And I was like, I had this whole dream sequence and, you know, this yeah. whole trip about it. And I was like, wow, that's, I'd never even thought of anything like that. So when I woke up, my military father's standing over me and he's like, are you okay, son? It's like after me sweating and freaking out for 8 or 10 hours sleeping. And I woke up and I said, and I looked around and I said, can I have a guitar? And he said, why would you want a guitar? And I went, I really want a guitar. And he goes, all right, you survived all this. I'll get you a guitar. So he got me a little acoustic guitar. And I said, I want an electric guitar. He says, no, you play this for a year. And if you're still into it.
So my mom did.
I'll help you get an electric guitar.
Yeah.
So I had to play classical gas and something, for, you know, dueling banjos or something for my dad would buy me an electric guitar. Right. And so I worked really hard for a year. Got the electric guitar, and I just completely forgot about being a paratrooper. Yeah. And otherwise, now, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I would be a retired paratrooper.
Yeah, a retired colonel.
Limping.
So probably. Did your dad was a career guy?
Yeah.
Army guy?
My dad was a CID agent. It's kind of like Army CIA.
Oh, that's cool.
And did a lot of really kind of spook-oriented stuff in Germany. He was in Korea and Germany and snuck people back and forth across the Berlin Wall and spied and, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, over the years, it's been really weird. Like, a funny story is, a few years ago, my band played in Germany. We played the Biesenthal Motorcycle Festival. It's the biggest show I have ever done. And Mark Smith and Mike Moyer were in the band and Scott.
Right.
And a couple days later, my booking agent said, we got this other gig for you in Berlin at this Mexican restaurant. I'm like, wow, really? A Mexican restaurant? Says, yeah, you want to do it? I was like, well, we're off that day. Let's do it. Whatever, right. We'll do it. He goes, yeah, the some American guy owns the place, right? Well, okay. So they had this basement set up of a Mexican food restaurant with a PA and lights for us. And it looks like they never had shows there before. So we're up having margaritas and stuff. And this guy walks in and goes, hey, Lance, how you doing? I was like, hey, what's going on? He goes, food's terrible here. You guys are from Texas. You hate it. Let's go down to this Chinese place down the street. So we're walking down the street. And he goes, do you want to know why I booked you? And I went, have no idea. And he goes, I served here with your dad in the late 60s in Berlin.
Wow.
He goes, I was a CID agent. I went, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, I met my wife. She was a communist East German. I met her and fell in love. And when the wall came down, I came right back here and retired and opened a Mexican food restaurant.
That is an amazing story.
Yeah. And so I said, let's call my dad.
Yeah.
So I called my dad and said, hey, somebody wants to talk to you, and just hand him the cell phone. Mm-hmm. And this guy goes, Bob? And I heard my dad go, whoa, and start laughing on the other end of the phone. And they totally caught up for about.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I've been linked to Germany quite a bit. I play there. That's where I play a lot overseas. And I lived there when I was a little boy for about 3 years.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you guys moved and traveled
a lot,
moved to different bases, different cities.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Where in Texas were you when you got that guitar?
Well,
I got the fever.
I was actually we were in Atlanta when that happened.
Okay.
We were in Atlanta when the fever thing happened. But my mother was from Iowa Park, Texas, which is south of Lawton, Oklahoma, where the Fort Sill is. Uh-huh. That's how my parents met, because she was going to business school in Wichita Falls, and he happened to be down near Iowa Park, met her. They got married. So we lived in Lawton, Fort Sill. I lived in Iowa Park, Texas on our off times when Dad was in Korea, and then we lived in Atlanta. And Atlanta was a trip during that time, because it was the 70s and it was a whole civil rights thing. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Wait, so were you an only child?
Yeah.
How was that?
Lonely, because
you're always moving places.
Always moving.
I had that too.
Yeah. Were you Army?
No. My mom was just a hippie.
Just moved a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll see. Our thing was at the Army bases. None of the kids ever really got very close, because I'm old enough where, you know, long distance phone calls were insanely expensive.
Right.
And
yeah.
Nobody liked to write letters, and internet wasn't invented, and right. So it's like you go, wow, I'm not even really going to become very close to anybody because I'm only going to be here a couple years.
Right.
And then you'd move someplace else, you know. So we moved a lot, you know.
So you were 10, what was that, like 1973?
I don't know. I'll be 50 New Year's Eve, so
If you somewhere can. Somewhere around then.
Yeah.
So it says here that you started playing at 12 in the bar scene.
Yeah, and in Oklahoma. We moved a lot in Oklahoma, and there was a band of older teens at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and somebody told them that I was a really promising young guitar player, and their guitar player had quit. And so they invited me over to this guy's garage on the Army base. And these guys were all like, you know, smoking cigarettes and drinking beer, like 16, 17. And I was 12.
Yeah.
And they went, well, you do all the parts. You want to be in the band? And I was like, well, yeah, okay. You know, so my folks agreed. And I was out playing bars in Oklahoma when I was 12.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it, were people like freaking on you? Like, I mean, we've seen those guys. I mean, I'm contemporaries with, you know, Will and Charlie and Ian and all these. What my friend John Sanchez calls blues fetuses.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I mean, Charlie was playing gigs around here when he was 12 and 13 years old.
Yeah,
I mean,
so you were one of those guys. That, I mean, were they kind of like, and this guy's 12?
Yeah.
Stage and stuff was a big deal?
Yeah, and it was really, you know, it was really kind of fun for me when I moved here and met, you know, at the time, little Charlie and Wayne and those guys. Because, you know, it was cute to go see Charlie in the same situation and go, well, I bet that's how other people perceive me. You know, it's like, because you never think of that when you're 12. You think of yourself as a, you know, fully developed human being. Yeah, and you're like, I'm just in this band. And people are going, no, you're a dwarf.
Yeah.
You know, so I was shorter, you know, they maybe wear like a cowboy hat and stuff to try to like dress me up, look a little older. Because, you know, some of the clubs I wasn't even allowed to be in.
Right.
So the doorman would go and wave when the cops were coming up the stairs. And we'd go, take a short break, be right back. And like, I'd go out and hide on the fire escape.
What were you playing? What kind of stuff were you playing?
Music-wise?
Yeah.
Covers? Yeah. No, it was kind of... Original? It was some original music. The guys that I first played with were really into the Beatles.
Okay.
And they were writing a lot of songs that kind of sounded like Beatle tunes, but they wrote a lot of original music. So we did some Beatles songs, we did some Stones, and we did some original songs. And, you know, we had a fun time of it for a few years, and then I moved away from there and formed another band elsewhere.
Where'd you go after that?
My dad's family's from Little Rock, Arkansas. So
it's a cool place.
I moved to Little Rock and put a band together there with some guys. And I actually, that was the first band I really kind of fronted. I was the guitar player, singer in that band. And we did a bunch of festival shows. We did the Arkansas Jam.
Yeah.
The first ever Arkansas Jam. That was fun.
Nice.
Yeah. And, you know, and so again, you know, by then I was like, you know, 15, 16 and already kind of a seasoned club player, you know.
And so at that time, were you like trying, I guess it was hard to get studio time then, and there was no like home recording stuff?
No, it was crazy though.
Tough.
I mean, there was one studio in Little Rock that we got to go in and record a little bit, and it, you know.
A lot of times for demos, even back then, you would have to go do live auditions, like coming tomorrow at 4.
Right, exactly. And the thing is that a lot of those studios were so expensive back then. I mean, it was crazy money to record, and you know, 2-inch tape was really expensive.
Yeah.
So that band in Little Rock actually did go in and do some recording, but the engineer was terrible, so the stuff didn't sound anything like the band. And, you know, it was one of those things, like, hey, that's a drag, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you how long were you in Little Rock?
I was in Little Rock about 2.5-3 years, and then we went back to Lawton, Oklahoma again, and I put together another band in Lawton where I fronted it and was a trio. And
what was the name of it?
Well, at that point, it was called Wolf Trap.
Yes. That is a cool name.
It was called Wolf Trap, WULF. Like there was a concert venue in Virginia. Our drummer had been in Virginia. His father had been stationed there, and there was a cool concert venue called Wolf Trap there. And so we named the band after that. It was just it was a 3-piece band. And some of the weirdest times of my life were spent in that band, because at the time, Lawton was like the Wild West. It was tons of bike gangs and you know, crazy women. And, you know, we were still high school age guys playing in these bars. And you know, our best friends were like banditos and like, you know, like, so it was really out of character for a high school kid. You know, I didn't hang out with any high school kids. I hung out with, you know,
banditos
and drug dealers. And, you know, it was pretty nuts.
Were you a troubled kid at that? Like, your dad was an Army guy. Was he ever like, Jesus, Lance, you gotta get it together?
No. It's funny. I didn't ever really get into like the whole drug and alcohol thing that much until I came here. Seriously. And when I moved to Austin,
I wish I had a great sound effect for that.
And then the alcohol and drugs started. Yeah, I mean, Lawton, I barely ever even drank. You know, I'd have a beer now and again and never did. You know, I smoked pot. Yeah. You know, and pot's not going to make you do anything crazy except sleep or eat something.
Or eat something weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, were you out touring around? And
yeah, we played all over like Oklahoma and North Texas. We played Wichita Falls and Lawton and Oklahoma City, and every now and then we'd go to Tulsa and play Tulsa. And so, you know, it was like one of those things where, weekdays we'd kind of sort of pretend to go to school, and then weekends we'd be gone, usually Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and come home on Sunday. And you know, think back now, it's like I had better gear really then than I even do now. I had a 57 Les Paul and a 60s Marshall, and we just thought that was normal because that's what you could buy for normal money.
Right.
You know, normal money back then. You just buy all that stuff, you know.
Or even worse is like, you know, you might have been like one of those kids, like I went through a phase of this, but it's because my development happened in the 80s.
Yeah.
Might not, it shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Right.
Because I'm like Mark Hallman, I was his roadie.
Mm-hmm.
And then like once I was tuned, like, putting his guitar strings on backwards on the tuners and shit, he promoted me to guitar player.
Awesome.
So I played with him, and it was a band like with him and Michael Ramos and stuff.
Awesome.
And he would give me stuff, like he'd give me gear instead of paying me.
Oh, wow.
And so I remember being all upset because I had this Boss Chorus Ensemble, the one that you plug in with the two.
The cool one, yeah.
Yeah, because it was big in 70s. I was like, I don't want this 70s thing. I'm going to get this, you know.
Little tiny 80s.
Yeah, one. Area Pro.
Yeah. Good Lord.
Yeah, genius.
Yeah, I think my biggest screw up like that was I told my dad, I said, I really need a second guitar. I mean, because, you know, we're breaking strings, we're doing all this stuff, and I want to buy another guitar. And my dad said, well, you know, I'll kick in, I'll help you buy a guitar. And there was a band signed to Capricorn Records from Lawton, Oklahoma, called Two Guns, that had like toured with, you know, the Allman Brothers and the Outlaws, right, and all stuff. And their guitar player had taken me under his wing, right? So he had a 59 white Strat with a rosewood board, like the first year they made rosewood.
Right.
And he's, back then they weren't worth that much. And he goes, I'll tell you what, man. He goes, why don't you just, you guys just give me like $1,200 and just take that 59 Strat. That'll be, you know, that way you'll have a really good second guitar.
Yeah.
So my dad and I went over, and Bobby wasn't home yet. My dad looks in the window and he goes, that old beat up white thing with the gold pick guard? Oh no, that's ugly, son. Let's go get you a new guitar.
Yeah.
So we went and got the Peter Frampton signature Electra MPC with built-in effects.
What built-in effects were there?
It had a booster and a phase shifter, so you could turn the phase shifter on. It was a little knob, so you could like speed up and slow down.
And he didn't really use that kind of guitar, did he? He only played that Les Paul that he's so famous for playing.
Right. So that kind of brings up a funny story. Back then, a lot of these stars would endorse gear they never laid hands on. So there's a picture of Peter Frampton with this Electra MPC with the built-in effects, and he never played that guitar. I don't think he owned one. And so, by the same token, the other guitar player in my band, the band that played all the kind of Beatle-y sort of stuff,
right,
he bought a Gibson Marauder because it was the signature guitar of Paul Stanley from Kiss. So we have first row tickets to Kiss, and I'm going, where's the Marauder, man?
Yeah.
Where's the Marauder? No, he's not playing it yet. Well, it's his signature guitar. Where's the freaking Marauder? So they come out for the encore, and Paul Stanley comes running out with the Marauder on it. And he goes, see, he's got my guitar. It's the same as my guitar. He smashes it and then puts the flying V back on. So it was the guitar Gibson developed for Paul Stanley to smash.
Yeah. So were you a Kiss guy then? Were you Kiss?
You know, I saw Kiss back when they were on tour recording Kiss Alive, the first one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I liked their stuff. And what happened to me, though, is that when I met the guys in Two Guns,
all right,
my best friend's sister was married to their guitar player, Bobby Williams, and Bobby came over to my house one day, and I just thought these were the coolest guys in the world. They had really long hair and beards and cowboy hats and He knocks on my door, and I answer the door, and he says, hey, let me see your record collection. And he walks in and he goes, you know, God, Kiss, Aerosmith. Yeah, yeah. Oh, my. Blah. So he goes, hold on, I'm taking all these. I'm going to give you this. So he came back and gave me, thank God, he gave me Cream, Disraeli, Gears, Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced, and like a Beatle album. And he goes, live with this for a while. And if you really want your Kiss records back, you can have them.
That's cool.
And luckily he did that because it helped my songwriting a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after, let's see, after high school.
Yeah.
What did you do? was your move?
Well, I was somehow I ended up stuck back in Lawton. We'd been kind of back and forth between Lawton and Little Rock, and Lawton was worse than Little Rock, really. And my dad and mom were going to buy a house there, and then they divorced, and it was a really bad scene. And I was dating this girl who was like, you know, the prettiest girl in town sort of thing. And our parents got together behind our backs and basically said, came to us and said, look, we'll pay for the two of you to move wherever you want to move if you get married, basically just to get rid of us.
Wow.
Yeah, because we were bad kids by then. You know, I was in a rock band and she was a model and drunk all the time. And so we got together and said, you want to be married? She's like, I don't want to be married to anybody. I don't want to be married to you or anybody else. And I said, yeah, but they're going to like pay to move us where we want to go. And she went, yeah, we're teenagers. So she goes, we'll do it. So we got married, got in the car, packed everything up. I didn't know anybody, and I just moved to Austin with her.
Wow.
And within 2 weeks, I had a job at the 7-Eleven on Congress. And somebody had said, people down at the Austin Opera House rehearse. You might go down there and hang out. And it was one of those weird things. I was hanging out back there, and these guys are walking out the back door arguing. They're about my age, a little older. And I said, hey, what's up? Hey, we're in the middle of something right now. I said, well, what's going on? Well, we just fired our guitar player, and we have a bunch of gigs coming up. And I went, well, I'm a guitar player. And the guy goes, you have gear with you? I said, I have gear in my car. And he goes, well, come on in here. So I met these guys and got this band together, and they realized I could sing and write songs, and it kind of became my band.
Wow.
And so I was working 5 days a week, full like 10 or 11-hour shifts at 7-Eleven, and going down to the Opera House and rehearsing with these guys every night. Within about a month, my wife was like in the party scene here, and she was like, I'm moving in with this guy out at the lake. And
right.
I was like, yeah, we'll just get a divorce, whatever. What? get out of here. I'm busy. You know,
why haven't we been hanging out this whole time?
I don't know.
That's all I've been thinking this whole time. I was like, what a great guy. Okay. So, at one point I thought you were going to say those two guys were like Ray Benson and Willie Nelson or something like that.
No. Well, but you know, I ended up, I think, only ever meeting Willie like once when he was doing Honeysuckle Rose there.
Oh, yeah?
And just, you know, thanked him for letting us rehearse there and told him that our electric bills were probably really high for him. And because we were paying some flat rate with no electric bill or anything. So we'd have these window units running in these rooms around the clock.
So they had rooms at the Opera House?
Yeah. You know where the Ark was?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a door to the back of the Opera House down at the end of the
street. Yeah, that goes into the studio.
When you walked in that back door before, the first door on the right was Eric Johnson's room.
Uh-huh.
The next door was Van Wilkes's room.
Uh-huh.
Around the corner was Shiva's headband.
Right.
And down at the end of the hall was this room that my drummer friend had that ended up being in my band.
Wow.
And so we had that room there, and that's how I met Eric and Van, you know?
Right.
In fact, my first good gig with the band, we were rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing, trying to get a gig. And we didn't want to do we were doing this kind of hard rock thing that nobody was really doing in Austin yet at the time. You know, it was real sort of, you know.
And were you a trio at the time, too?
Uh-huh, uh-huh, okay. Uh-huh.
So you guys kind of had that. Was Eric a trio? So I remember at one point, like when I first met Mark Hallman, Eric was this kind of wunderkind that he had taken on the road with him with Carole King.
Right. And
was that around or before that time?
No, it was after that.
Okay, so like 82,
80? Yeah, 82, 83. Okay. And so he was playing with, I think Tommy was already on drums, uh-huh. and he had some jazz guy on bass. I don't remember the guy's name. But then Van was also a trio. He had a trio.
Right.
He had guys with him. And then I was a trio at the end of the hall. Well, the way we got our first cool gig, bless his heart, is we were walking out one night from rehearsal at like midnight, and Van's room is open. And I was like, oh, he's never here this late. I was like, Van. Nobody says anything. I'm like, I'm going to go in there and make sure everything's okay. Maybe somebody's hurt, you know. I walked in, nobody was in there. And he's got 50 strats and like killer gear everywhere. And I was like, somebody's got to call somebody. So I said, I'm staying here. I trust me.
Yeah.
You guys go get to a payphone and call Steamboat or 6th Street Live at the time down the street and try to get Van's phone number and call him. So Van comes screaming up in his car and comes in. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This is unbelievable. He's like walking around. Everything's there. And he's like, I can't thank you enough. And I said, what happened? He goes, I think my bass player was just high or something and didn't lock the door or close the door. And I went, oh my God. He goes, he said, if there's ever anything I can do for you. Pardon me.
You're like, well, Van Wilkes.
Yeah. He's like, is there anything I could do for you? And I said, you're playing Sixth Street Live Friday night. Can I open the show? And he's like, absolutely, you're on. That was our first gig.
Sixth Street Live, just for perspective's sake for me, that's the place that was the Hard Rock?
Yeah.
Okay. And or ended up being a Hard Rock later on.
Yeah, it was a very cool room. And at the time, Van was very
popular.
They used
to videotape the shows there, too, because I remember like coming to visit... you know, we would come visit Mark and his family and stuff, and he'd show me videos that he had done for playing there.
It was
Van was extremely popular. Then he had his song on the radio and stuff with the Boys Town and
around that time. So instead of us doing a bunch of tiny like Monday night gigs, the first gig I did in Austin was on a Friday opening for a sold out show with Van, which was great because then the Chronicle started writing about my band because we were weird and looked different and played all this hard rock stuff and had makeup on. And
so when you, okay, so give us... are you saying like 83?
Yeah.
82, 83?
Yeah, 82, 83-ish.
And when you're saying it was like hard rock, and in my idea, there was like an underground hard rock, and then there was like Quiet Riot.
We were more like Dokken-y, Quiet Riot. But we were...
Still cool music, not just Bonehead, Come On, Feel the Noise.
Right, but... And our stuff was all kind of dark and sinister. Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, playing a bunch of strange... Van Halen and Malmsteen-y sort of things, but we were a trio, so it was a little different than some of those bands. But you know, so it was at the time, most people in Austin either thought we were a joke or they really liked us. You know, there was no in between.
Yeah.
There was no in between. It was like, you know, you guys are a freaking joke, or I'm in the front row. There was no in between.
Yeah,
you know, so
it's kind of how this town has that. Like that's how I felt when I had Mr. Rocket Baby. Like knowing going into it, like. Some people are just going to look at us and start laughing and walk out the door, but maybe some won't.
Well, see, and you got to remember, it's like, you look at like the Chronicle, right? One of the things that I always remember just vividly is how Charlie was their baby. They loved Charlie. They loved Charlie. They loved Charlie.
Till he did well.
Charlie, then as soon as he did well, I'll never forget this. I read somewhere in the Chronicle one week where they said, something about a different band in town going into the studio to do their record. And the guy said, they'll probably spend less money on the record than Charlie spent on bolo ties last week. You know, just...
So what?
Just crap like that. You know what I mean? So it's like, why does having a successful record suddenly make you a jerk, you know?
They do that here. I mean, I went through that too. I mean, did you go through that when you got signed to Atlantic?
Did you
come home and like go to Steamboat and you're like... There was a dude one night, like we were signed to a label that was owned by Lars Ulrich, and at some point Lars wanted to play drums on a song, and I indulged him, and he did it, and it was not right for the song, and he ended up not doing it. But I was in LA for like 6 weeks, maybe 2 months. I came back, and they were closing Steamboat. It was like that week, and I was here for a couple of days, and so I went and hung out, and there was a guy that was just... Like I can't remember his name, but he was part of that whole scene, and I was like, "Hey, how you doing?" He's like, "Fucking
sell out."
Yeah. I'm like, what's the problem? And he's like, "Dude, I heard you fired the whole band. You're having like all these LA dudes playing on your record."
Oh my god!
No, dude. Well, why would I do that?
with us, when we came back from New Jersey, we were in Jersey almost a year doing, you know, pre-production. This record we did with Jack Ponte, who had worked with like Bon Jovi and different people, you know. And so obviously the record ended up not sounding like I would have even wanted it to sound. It was so much more commercial than I would have done. But it was one of those things like, we're finally
signed. Same with me, yeah.
We're finally signed, and you end up getting this mindset like, I'm stuck here, and I'm with these songwriters, and I'm with these producers, and it's like, you know, before you know it, you lose your own identity.
Well, not only that, I mean, I don't know if anyone ever sent you veiled threats, but it was like, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, if this record doesn't sell, you won't make another one. So, don't listen to me. I'm just a guy in the music business. You know.
Well, actually, like, okay. I had a worse one than that. I don't know if you remember. You may not remember, but the single that we had that did okay was called "The Party's Over," and it did well around here and in the markets they promoted it did really well. It was top two.
It came out on like 91 or something.
91.
Like that.
It was top.
It's right when I moved here.
Top 10. One of the top 10 songs of the year on KLBJ at the time. And we got a lot of airplay, and they flew me up to Atlantic's office. So I was on ATCO East West. So they flew me to the Atlantic office, and I'm at this little board meeting. And I'm already so pissed off at the way they've handled everything.
Yeah.
And they pull out this poster, right? And it's this really cool photograph that David Michael Kennedy, this killer photographer, took of me. And it says, "The party's over," and then has "not," like from Wayne's World. I said, "Look, you guys, you can't put that out. That's silly." And this guy, this New York promo guy, he goes, "You listen to me." "You either do things the way I say they're going to be done, or I'll ruin your career." And in front of about 10 people, I went, "I'll shoot you in the face." And he goes, you what? And I went, "I will shoot you in the face." He goes, "With a gun?" I'm like, "Yeah, with a gun. I'll shoot you in the face." And he goes, "I'm leaving." And he like walks out of the room. And I was like, "Okay, now who wants to talk? Who else wants to talk about the party's over?" Not.
I got to tell you, I had this experience with a guy that I know you know, because I remember one night the first time I ever like had a longer conversation with you than like 5 minutes was at a Hamstein Christmas party.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know why I remember it so well, but. My experience was with Richard Perna, and I went on a writing trip to LA, and I came back and I had to play him the songs, and I was with the A&R guy that was trying to get me signed to their company and then playing the songs for Richard Perna. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so we finished the last song, and it was like when Austin Powers had just come out, and, it was and he turns around and it's hard to trust a 60-year-old dude that turns around and is all fat and goes, "Shagadelic, baby. Shagadelic."
Oh, my God.
I was just like, I told Martin, the guy that was my A&R guy there, I was like, "Dude, I don't ever want to go to one of those fucking meetings again. You playing those songs by yourself."
No, it's scary.
Because that just made me want to puke.
Like, you know, my A&R person at ATCO East West was really the person that they did. They modeled Bobby Fleckman after from Spinal
Tap. That's amazing.
She is the real person. Yeah, yeah. Her name's Wendy Goldstein. And she is Bobby Fleckman. You know,
the hostess with the mostess.
Yeah, because we go, "Hey, listen, you know, I love Jack and everything, but he keeps wanting to write with us, and it's like I can't have the words ever again in my songs that are taken by surprise or fire burning in me. None of those are going to work for me. That's all Bon Jovi shit. We're not going to have it in my songs." And she goes, "Ha ha 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 ha, have a coffee." And I was like,
"That'll make it all better."
Did you hear what I just said? You know, yeah, that's kind of, and yeah, back to the Chronicle thing. It's like, yeah, they did that to me too. I came back from the Atlantic thing, and I think Margaret or somebody, KLBJ was really helping us, and she didn't like that. And I guess, and she, there was something written to the effect that I was a heroin addict, that I'd become a heroin addict while I was in New York. And I wasn't, but girls started bringing me soup and stuff. It was awesome. My drummer, Kevin, was going, "You should put little spots on your arm.
Yeah.
We should, like, poke you with stuff." You know, because it was like, everybody said, he's like, "Oh, we have to take care of you. We have to take care of you." And then somebody in the magazine, about 2 weeks later, alluded to the fact that I was gay, that I was bisexual. And the funniest thing is the person who wrote that was downtown a few nights later. And I had been to this party with my gay friends that they had every Valentine's Day where they'd all cross-dress, right?
Right.
And I'm downtown with Deborah Carter, my old best friend. Yeah. And literally a basketball player from UT in a red dress. And this person for the Chronicle sees me standing next to this guy, and they're like, "Oh, my God, I made it up."
It's
true. And there it is.
I wished it.
And I was like, "Hello." You know, but yeah.
So, how did you end up getting signed to Atlanta and to Atlantic?
Oh, well,
or to ATCO?
Yeah, what happened was in the mid '80s, I was being courted. I lived in LA. I lived in LA briefly, but I lived in New York, and I was managed by Brendan Burke, who had managed Billy Idol.
Uh-huh.
And so we had big showcase up there, and a bunch of labels were interested, and A&M Records.
That's the name dropping police, by the way.
Yeah.
No, I'm just fucking with you.
So A&M Records were kind of courting the band.
Right.
And one of the things they made me do is go write with Jack Ponte. Mm. And so I met Ponte before Ponte was even very big. I mean, I think he had just written Runaway with Bon Jovi or something. Okay. It was a big hit, right? And so we wrote for about a week, and the A&R guy that was trying to sign me got fired. And so, okay, we're back to the drawing board. And Jack goes, I'm not going to forget about you. And I was like, okay, thinking I'll never hear from this guy again. Right. So he calls me in late 89 and said, out of the blue, I mean, he just goes, Lance, it's Jack, what's going on? I'm like, well, I'm just playing gigs around Austin. What's going on with you? And he says, are you with Brendan anymore? I was like, no, Brendan and I aren't working together. He goes, okay, listen, I'll just talk to you directly. Then he goes, I can get you one of two things right now. I said, okay, what? And he goes, you can either be Alice Cooper's guitar player for this tour that's coming up, and he's already heard you. He says it's cool, because he was working with Alice Cooper at the time. Or he goes, I can get you signed to this new label called...
I met him that year.
Huh?
Sorry, I met Alice Cooper that year. Sorry, it has nothing to do with anything.
You met Alice Cooper?
That same year in 89.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, when he did Hey Stupid and that...
I don't know, I walked into a record store and he had just done a signing, but I went go pick up a couple of blank tapes and this guy said, here's my new band right here. And he put his arm around me and turned around. I was like, what the hell? And I was like, oh my God, it's Alice Cooper. Yeah.
That's fun.
Sorry, yeah.
That's fine. Yeah, so Jack said there's this new label called East West. And he goes, it's freaking me out because all they're doing is kind of urban.
Right.
But they're offering to give you a deal if I produce. And I went, well, I'd rather have a record deal than just a tour. I've done tours. I mean, let's do that. And he goes, I have no idea what's going to happen. Well, this could have been a great deal because the woman behind that label, Sylvia Roan, was actually a brilliant person. Yeah. What she was trying to do is get two or three or four rock bands lined up because she knew she was taking over ATCO.
Yeah.
And she thought, this will marry the two companies. We'll work on these things together. It'll be a happy family.
Yeah.
No. So when they fired Vince Ferraci and the guys that were running ATCO, which I love Vince too, they fired all of them and said, now it's all just her people running both labels. The people that were left from ATCO, which were radio promotion people and stuff, were like,
yeah,
you're her band. No, fuck you. We're not going to promote your record. And we were like, but it's like top 10 phones all over Texas. And well, you're from Texas. I'm like, Texas is the size of freaking Germany, man. Promote the damn record.
Yeah.
They wouldn't do it.
Oh.
It was, you know, I mean, I would have never said this in front of other Austin musicians until I got older and less weird, but that was the most screwed up year of my life.
Sure. The most terrifying time. I had the same, that was the president of Elektra when I was there. Sylvia.
Yeah, so you know Sylvia.
Well, I met her once, and it was like, it was literally, did you ever see that thing you do?
Yeah.
You know, when they meet the they get their picture taken with the president label,
you
and then they walk away, and he goes, so I was thinking about when we start doing our album. He's like, why is this fucking kid talking to me? Why is this kid, you know? That's what I felt like when I met her. I felt like she was like, why is this guy even fucking talking to me?
You know what she did for me, though, that was really, really cool? I caught her head of A&R completely fucking us around, or head of AOR radio completely messing us around. And she knew that I knew the guy had done it.
Right.
And I called and said, I'd like a meeting with Sylvia. And May, who I think is still her assistant to this day, is a wonderful person. May went, you know, baby, I'm gonna get that for you.
Yeah.
So they said, fly up next week. We're sending you a ticket. Monday morning, you're in front of Sylvia. And so Monday morning, I went and sat down in her office, and I said, listen, you know that me and Family Stan and a few other bands got completely hosed by your radio people. And you know, a lot of us, I got to be frank with you, we've worked our whole lives for this. We're not just some weird pop kid that shows up out of nowhere.
It's one thing you want to say to them.
You know,
it's like, this is my life.
And I said, this has been really, really awful for me. This has been a terrible experience.
Yeah.
She goes, what can I do to make that better for you? And I said, give me a release so I don't owe you two more records. Don't let me owe you any money from what we've done so far, and give me $10,000 to go make a record for somebody else. She goes, you can't make a record for 10 grand. I said, I can in Austin. She went, write him a check.
Yeah.
You're released. Here's your release. Here's your check. So sorry this went down the way it did. I went over to Freddie at Arlen and said, hey, I've got some money. She said, let's do a record. We knocked out a record that ended up getting us signed in Europe.
That's great.
And Sylvia had no idea at the time that they paid for an entire record. She thought at that time $10,000 was a demo budget.
Right.
They paid for the whole record.
I remember during that time hearing another song too, Let's Go Bowling and Drink Some Beer.
Yeah, that's a joke song.
There's A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know how that ended up on the record? It shouldn't have ended up on the record. What happened was is we used to open for Van all the time. So we're at the back room. He had Boys Town, right? Right. So I was actually...
That kind of has that vibe.
I was actually giving Van... I was giving him a hard time. He's still sitting out there, and I started going, you know, and he's like looking at me, and I just, out of my stupid face comes, let's go bowling and drink some beer. And so, you know, Mike Moyer starts singing background, you know. And so we just wrote this whole stupid thing at soundcheck. And for some reason that night we'd had a bunch of whiskey or something, and we went...
I started it.
And the crowd went nuts over that song and then loved it and loved it and loved it. So I thought, well, this is cool. I'm going to be a singer-songwriter now. I'm done with all that stuff. And we got to New Jersey, and the first thing Jack Ponte says, we got to do Let's Go Bowling and Drink Some Beer. I said, where did you even hear that?
Yeah.
I said, I had somebody record you guys with a cassette tape, and I've heard it. You got to do the song. And I was like, I don't want to do that song. But, I mean, if we have time, I have to tell you.
We have time.
The most embarrassing thing about Let's Go Bowling and Drink Some Beer is... in Detroit, my record was doing really well on Detroit Wheels Radio, and they invited Cole Hansen, my other guitar player, and I up there to do this really cool show that they did every few months where they would have a really famous person and a really new person on the same day. And they did it at this bowling alley. I should have seen this coming. And we had a song called Anadarko that actually got me adopted by the Sioux Nation. And it was like this really deep, meaningful song for Native people because I'm quarter Cherokee. Okay. And I'm thinking, that's the song we're going to do. And Cole's like, yeah, we ought to do that song. That'll be great because we only had one song. And so Lindsey Buckingham was the other person on the gig. And so I was like, wow, man, such a pleasure to meet you. And Lindsey was like, very nice. He was like, oh, yeah, good luck with your career. You know, I mean, I'm sure you guys will have a lot of fun with this. And, you know, I've had a lot of fun. Just really gracious.
Yeah.
And so we're about to play, and I'm going, I'm going to impress Lindsey Buckingham with my songwriting skills. And we go, and I said, this is a song called Anadarko. It's about the Native American struggle in the United States. And the DJ goes, it's not what you're going to play. And I went, what? And he goes, what do we want to hear? An entire Detroit bowling alley yells out, let's go bowling and drink some beer.
And I was just like, flattering.
And I was like,
should have been.
And Cole goes, no. And then they went, let's go bowling and drink some beer. And we went, da 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 da. And Lindsey Buckingham's on the couch looking at us like, what the heck? And so we finished, and they were getting us out the door to go to the airport before the show was even over. And I'm trying to say goodbye to Lindsey, and Lindsey's like kind of laughing, and he goes, yeah, I guess I'll do a song, another song, now that Lance has done that. I guess I'll do one you've probably heard before called Go Your Own Way.
Oh, yeah.
And I went, oh, fuck.
Boom.
I'm like the most embarrassed I've ever been in my whole life, yeah. I wish we hadn't done that on the record. It was...
You know, I had a song like that, and it was going to be our second single on the record, and I didn't want to put it on the record because the chorus was, I can't be your bitch anymore.
I like that.
You think so, but you realize that, like, oh, this is, we're going to get kind of like Ugly Kid Joe'd. You know what
right.
I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, we're going to be that, I hate everything about you kind of band.
Yeah.
So,
I played with the bass player from Ugly Kid Joe.
Oh, you did?
Cordell.
Yeah. What did they think about what happened? Did they go back and go like, shit, we had other songs that were like regular songs?
No, the band, from what I remember from talking to Cordell Crockett, because before I got signed to Atlantic or ATCO East West, Ian Moore and I actually were hired by EMI Records to play with this guy named Tim Carr.
Okay.
And Cordell Crockett from Ugly Kid Joe was the bass player, and he told us the whole story, and he was like, it was just really rough for us, he goes, because we had this single... And nothing that weird and funny to follow it up with because we were a serious band.
Right.
So we just kind of fell apart. And he said that the band just kind of stopped. They were like, what do we do now? And they just quit.
You know? There's nowhere to go really from there.
No.
It's kind of weird.
Right. It's like, you know, who does Captain Kirk play after Captain Kirk?
Except, exactly.
You know.
T.J. Hooker.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You're right. That guy from the travel commercials.
So, you worked with another guy, new Phil Lewis. Remember when he lived here?
Yeah, I worked with Phil. That was awesome. That was so much fun.
It was an interesting... He's still out there?
Yeah.
I saw him on something. I saw him on, you know, that metal show. You ever see that?
Yeah.
That was a big inspiration for me to do this show, because I like that guy, Eddie Trunk, and I like those comedians
they're a lot. Good. Yeah, they're funny. And you know what's hilarious is I got that gig by accident because Kevin... Who's the guy that's now the country star that was in Dangerous Toys? Kevin
Fowler.
Yeah. So Kevin Fowler was playing with him. And then Kevin had some other gigs to do someplace else. And I my buddy Scott Hinkle was playing bass for Phil and said, oh, you ought to get Lance. It'd be great. So went over there, played a couple days with him, and Phil said, yeah, you got the gig. So then my old drummer, Kevin, well, he's changed his name a bunch now. But
yeah, Kevin Pearson.
Yeah, Kevin Pearson.
It's Kevin Lance now.
That's funky. Yeah. That's really weird considering. Yeah. But yeah, so Kevin kept bumping me. Come on, man, get me in that gig too. Come on. So we ended up getting him the gig. So we went out and did a bunch of shows. And Phil's, at the time, his wife's parents' holiday Rambler Winnebago. We traveled all over the place.
What was her name? She was so nice.
I don't remember her name. She was sweet, though.
Yeah.
And they had that girl baby that they called Chicken Dinner.
Yeah, Chicken Dinner.
Yeah. But that was like, you know, that was a drug and alcohol crazed summer.
And was it? Was that 93 he was around?
Oh, dude.
Was that 93 or 94, one of those?
My quarter Cherokee-ness means I cannot remember numbers or years. But yeah, it was that around that time. It was after I was over the whole Atlantic thing and
right
back here just trying to figure out what to do.
Now, I don't know if we did shows together, but I remember seeing you play a few times at Steamboat during that time, like when I was in Mr. Rocket Bay. By then, when you came back from your experience with That Co.
Yeah.
I think then my band was already going.
Yeah.
And
you were. We were loud.
Yeah.
We were a loud band.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you guys actually may have played on some dates with us at Steamboat a couple times.
Maybe. Yeah. But I remember seeing you there and we both had black hair then.
We did.
Yeah. It was the era.
Of people had black hair then.
Yeah. That's true.
That was kind of the thing.
Yeah.
You know, Phil still had his black hair at the time, you know. And
he still does. When I saw him on that metal show, it was a little...
Really?
It starts to look a little funny once you pass a certain age.
You know what's really hilarious is I've done a lot of records with, you know... Have you ever met Andy Johns when he's been in town?
Uh-huh.
Okay, Andy produced, like, the Stones and Zeppelin.
I knew he did a record with you.
Yeah. And Andy's now dyed his hair black, and he's in his 60s. And British people dye their hair black in their 60s. They look like old women.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, like McCartney did a few years ago when he was dyeing his hair brown or whatever.
Yeah, you start to look like an unattractive British woman.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, or like the guy from Aerosmith, Steven Tyler.
Yeah.
Looks like a weird old lady.
He kind of, yeah.
So you guys, you went around, you played, and I know that you went and you started doing more in Europe then?
Well, after that, yeah. Kevin Womack, who had helped me over the years. I mean, it's so funny because Kevin, for years, from the 80s on, he would manage me for a little while and he'd go, oh, man, it's just not working. I'd go, oh, yeah, I know, I'm sorry. And he'd go, yeah, me too. We were always friends, right? Yeah. We'd split as friends every time.
Yeah.
And so finally he called me up and I was playing around doing some stuff and he'd heard the band doing the kind of material we were doing and he called up and said, you know, I think I can get you a deal in Europe. I went, all right, well, let's see, you know? And what had happened to lead up to that is I wasn't interested in recording at all. I was done. I was pretty much like, yeah, you know, if I get hired to play guitar, it's fine. I'm not going to do any solo work ever again. And I met these people that had this little production company, and they said, you know, we really want to get behind you. And I was like, why? Why would you get behind me? That's stupid. You know, you won't make any money. And, you know,
I'll crush your dreams.
It's that whole post major label thing where you just go, no, it's stupid. Don't give me any money. No,
I am not a wise investment.
No, don't, exactly. if you spend money on me, you're just going to, like, you might as well flush it down the toilet, you know? Yeah. No, we really have to do it. I said, okay, listen, if you can get Andy Johns to produce the record, I'll do it. And they freaking got Andy. And so I went, all right, I'll do the record. So I did the record, and then Kevin heard the record and said, Ed Von Zeel at Provoke Records wants to sign you. And I was like, oh, okay. So we got signed by Ed, and then started playing Europe a lot.
And that was the 90s. You spent most of the 90s doing that.
Yeah.
And making records and going and doing like a cycle and touring over there a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you like that?
It's awesome. But yeah. I mean, compared to here, I don't know if, have you played Europe?
No, but I've been.
Okay.
I mean, I kind of played, what was the French guy with the place that was like a Bennigan's?
Oh.
Fajitas and stuff.
In Paris? Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I never played there. That was the Chesterfield Cafe, right? Yeah.
I did like, hey, go ahead and play while you're here and we'll see what you're like. So that's the extent of my playing there.
Oh, I got it. Well, the difference is like this. During that time in Austin, I would show up at a club with a well-rehearsed band to a drunk, drugged out sound man who didn't even want to take the time to mic everything, let alone do a good job. to nothing backstage at all, to not getting paid what we were promised we were going to get paid, or the, seeing 500 people in the club, knowing they all paid, and they go, oh, well, here's how much the door was tonight. And it's like, you know, $115 or something, you know. And, you know, it, it went from that to you go to an average club, even clubs smaller than Steamboat, in like Dusseldorf, and they would have a 4 or 5 man union crew, move your gear in and out, catalog everything, make sure nothing's lost, professional sound guy, killer gear.
Maybe the sound guy listened to your record.
Right, and he knew all the songs, knew the effects for the vocals.
Exactly.
And then you'd go backstage, and there every single thing you'd put on your rider that had always been ignored in the United States is all there.
Yeah.
And I and it it shocked me the first tour we did because it was so unbelievable. I walked into this one club, and the spread was just phenomenal. And the club owner's there, and I was kidding, and I went, wow, what, no strawberries? And the guy goes, oh, I'm sorry, Lance. And he like starts to run. I'm like, oh, dude, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
They brought back strawberries. You know, I'm like going, you know, we're just nobodies from Austin, and they treat you with respect, and people come to the shows and like your music, and it's you know, it's a cool vibe.
Yeah.
But it kind of ruins you for playing here when you do that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of friends that felt like they got accepted there.
Yeah.
And here it was just, you know, a series of mishaps almost.
Well, yeah. I mean, I always, my thing with that, with any band guys I've ever played at, with in Austin, I've kind of, the few things I've always said is like, look, if the Rolling Stones played in their hometown every Friday and Saturday night for 15 years doing the same shit, people would stop coming, even if they're the Rolling Stones. Yeah, you know what I mean?
That's true.
And it's, and I, that's what's happened to most of us here. It's like, you know, it's not that any, there's so much talent in this town, it's unbelievable. It's just that people are jaded and, you know, they've seen you play so many times. It's like, well, I'll go next time.
Yeah. And I don't know if this happens to you, but, you know, definitely doing this podcast and being able to sit down and have this conversation with a lot of peers that I don't ever get to have these kind of conversations with.
Right.
There's no, there's always that weird feeling sometimes that people are like, you're not getting stuff and everyone else is getting the stuff. And everyone always thinks that someone's got it better than they do and stuff, but they really don't. It's just a matter of, it's weird. It's hard to sort of navigate that sort of thing because I feel like, on one hand, people reserve their enthusiasm for you because they don't want to lose any for themselves. Does that make sense? Happens with the artists.
Yeah.
And to me, this is like a real, like in the music community, even though you and I don't cross paths that much, we're in the same
community.
Sure, yeah. And we are the, more than there are people going to see music, we are the actual patrons of the shows, regular patrons of shows. Like,
sure.
I go see people play, you go see people play.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It seems like at a certain point, people are able to sort of champion other bands without feeling like they're losing anything themselves. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that was really kind of odd for me is I kind of tried to find out about the whole European connection for a long time. And there was this like almost like secret club here in Austin where it's like, we're not going to tell you how we did it.
Yeah.
And it's like, why? It's Europe's a continent. It's not going to hurt you if somebody else from here goes too.
It might even help.
It might help.
Yeah.
No. We can't do that. We can't do that. And you know, a few years ago, I had a disastrous thing I tried to do and totally messed it up. We tried to put together a record company in Austin specifically for helping Austin artists go to Europe.
Oh, okay.
And we ran out of money a lot faster than we would, and some of the backers fell on the wayside. And of course, all the bands blame me because I put the thing together. I was like, and they're all like, "Oh, it's all your fault that you know we're not not getting to go to Europe." And I'm like, "There's no money, you know, for us to send you to Europe." Sorry. I mean, we had a few investors that promised a lot more money than they actually ended up putting in. So. But, you know, what I was trying to do was a good thing. What I was trying to do is get all these other people an opportunity to go play like I had, you know, because it's a blast to go play there. And if you do it consistently enough, you actually make money, you know, and it's fun.
Well, there's guys like, the one guy comes to mind is like Calvin Russell is almost like a superhero over there. You know?
Man, yeah. Calvin came in, we were recording at Arlen years and years ago, when I was recording the first record, ended up being released in Europe. And Calvin walked in there just coming back from having played. And he was so big in France, he ended up moving there.
Yeah.
And he was showing me photos. And he goes, "Oh, yeah, check this out. This will blow your mind." And it's like, tonight, this big marquee, Calvin Russell with special guest Little Village.
Yeah.
Little Village was opening for Calvin Russell.
Yeah.
And here he would play like, you know, the hole in the wall, nobody would come.
Yeah, yeah.
And in Paris, he was like Elvis.
Yeah. That happened with a lot of like regular pop people too. Like, what was that, Cotton Mather?
Yeah.
They would, you know, they were touring, playing Wembley Stadium with Oasis there. And then like hole in the wall, literally like quarter full.
Yeah.
So, which is weird.
Well, the other interesting thing for bands in Europe, which we got to do a lot, which would, in the summer, it'd be really funny because, like, you know, one night we'd play at the Bozpop Festival in front of, you know, 25,000 people.
Yeah.
And the next night we'd be in a club the size of the Hole in the Wall or Continental Club.
Yeah.
And then the next night you'd be outside again, you know, big PA and everything. It was this night after night you never
knew what you were going.
Uh-uh.
It's still exciting and fun.
It is.
So do you go there still? Do you still go a little bit?
I haven't been in a little while. I had a booking agent contact me actually last week and ask if I want to go again because I haven't been in probably three, four years.
Does Van go over there?
He was going over more than he is. I don't know if he is now. We barely see each other, but he was going for a little while.
I saw him recently. And I always want to ask him to do this show. I really, like, I have a tremendous amount of respect for him.
Yeah.
Like, I love, he's a real deal.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you look at somebody like Van Wilkes, it's like, I think that probably, you know, the only thing that kept Van from being much, much, much bigger than he was when he was big was that he was managed by Hammstein and sort of in the shadow of ZZ
yeah.
Top.
And they would... Yeah, that was definitely like one of those. They weren't going to
keep you from being any bigger than you are, kind of thing. You know.
Yeah, better to sign the kind of like what happened with was it Pariah?
You're right.
You know, that guy kind of signed them so that they would get the Guns N' Roses. They'd clear the way for Guns N' Roses because then if they signed with another label, they'd be the competition.
Sure.
So it's just cheaper to buy them and fuck them. Yeah.
And they were awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, if you looked at that whole roster back then at Hammstein, you had like Eric that was kind of sat on for a long time and Van that didn't get to do as much as he should, maybe. I mean, I don't know the details, but...
And Billy, it doesn't seem like just from the little couple of times that I've met Billy Gibbons, he doesn't seem like a guy that would... He would want Van to do well and he would want Eric to do well.
Oh, of course.
It would only bring more sunshine to...
Of course.
...our... You know, community.
I'm not pointing a finger at anybody. It's just sometimes when people are all on the same roster like that, it just kind of happens, you know. But, you know, I mean, think about the ridiculous amount of talent that's in this town that is still even unrecognized. A lot of us have already been through our sort of like, this was our mythical sort of career time, and it's kind of back down the other side.
Yeah.
But there's so many great kids here that are really talented and so many older guys that go down. I could go any given night, it's... At Antone's and go, holy crap, there's more talent on this stage in one night in Austin than there probably is anywhere else in the world. You know? And
definitely.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny is I'll have someone, you know, sitting where you are now and having a conversation with them and they'll be talking about, you know, how when they were 15 and the big band was Limp Bizkit mm-hmm. and stuff. And you just go like, oh, wow, I'm really old.
Yeah,
so much older. Like Limp Bizkit was like your favorite band in high school.
Yeah, what's your oldest influence? Limp Bizkit.
But I mean, you know, I guess that's Adam Sultan, the guitar player guy. He was on here and we were talking and I was like, there's always that movie Midnight in Paris where there was always, you know, shit was really badass, you know. In the 70s, like that's when it was all, and then, oh, the 80s were really happening. You should have been there. That's when it was happening. Now it's all shit. And he's like, somewhere there's a vampire that's really pissed off because nothing's beaten his time when Beethoven was around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like Beethoven kicks all your asses.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any guys now, what's new that you're like, hey, this is going somewhere. I like this.
In town?
Or anywhere in the world.
Yeah. I'd have to think about that. You know, I was...
You like the White Stripes?
White Stripes
Not the
great.
White Stripes, the Black Keys.
Oh, that's the Black Keys are cool. I like them. I like them better when they were a smaller band.
Yeah.
And you know who I was a huge fan of and I wished he was still here was Chris Whitley.
Yeah.
Chris was so awesome.
Yeah.
Such a great talent.
You have a great slide technique.
Oh, thanks.
Just from what I was watching and hearing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny. It's like, you know, I've kind of found myself as a guitar player really late. You know, it's like I played a lot like other people for years and years and years. And totally by accident, I was working on a record with my friend Carmine Rojas.
I saw you play with him. What's he like as a guy?
He's one of the nicest people in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw him play live that I know of at the Sirius Moonlight Tour, but I knew who he was.
Yeah.
I was super into him.
He took me under his wing in New York after that tour. Mm-hmm. And really helped me so much. And he's just a tremendous guy. He plays with Joe Bonamassa now.
Okay.
But he played with Rod for years. Got me the Rod Stewart gig, actually.
And so you played with Rod Stewart?
Briefly.
How was that?
It's funny. I got fired like almost immediately. And the reason was is I think Rod hired me because I could play slide and I had longer hair. I was like 15 years younger than the next youngest guy in the band or something. And he kind of went, oh, let's get some, you know, fresh blood in the band. So I did the video with him for his single and I was in the video.
What was it?
It was called I Can't Deny It. It didn't do great.
Okay.
I
like to fuck with Ian McLaughlin and sing him really terrible, like cheesy, like Love Touch and shit like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So basically we went into rehearsals, right? And first of all, I've never been a gig guy that would have to go out and learn a lifetime of music in a week.
Yeah, that's
I kind of had to. So number one, I was nervous as shit because I'm playing with Rod Stewart. I'm trying to learn 30 or 40 songs in a week. And I'm like, oh, man, this is crazy. So we go into rehearsals. Things start going pretty well. And then all of a sudden, Rod walks in one day and they said, hey, we've decided we're going to do half a set of his new jazz record, like a half show of the jazz record, half show of the rock record. I literally raised my hand and said, hey, excuse me, I can't do that. There's just no way. I'm not a jazz player. I don't know those chords or anything.
And Rod, like his standards thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Rod thought I was kidding and says to the rest of the band, all right, that's it. No more funny chords. Lance is in the band. And I went, wait, seriously? And so when we're on break, I thought he and I had a pretty cool rapport. And we were on break and we're standing in the hallway. I said, can I talk to you? And he goes, yeah, come on, let's talk. So I said, listen, man, I've been a fan of yours since I was a little boy. And to me, you're right up there. You know, you know, it's like there's you, there's Mick Jagger, there's like, you know, these guys I've always wanted to play with. And I'm so excited to be playing with you. And I said, I know your jazz thing is important to you. And I said, but I have an idea. And he goes, oh, really? Okay, what's your idea? And I said, why don't you put together a jazz band and go do a jazz tour and strip the rock thing way down to like almost Faces. And do Faces tunes and old Rod Stewart songs and the rockin'est stuff that you've done in the last 15 or 20 years only.
Yeah.
Put on the leather pants. We'll all rock ourselves out. We'll go play 3,000 seat theaters where you charge obscene money for people to come see you do the rock shit. We'll get Ian on keyboards. It will rock.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, thanks for your advice. He goes, I'm going to take that into consideration. He goes, all right, lad. Great. All right. Pass me on the back. I went back to where I was staying going, man, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I may have made a difference.
Yeah.
Carmine calls and goes, I don't know what you did, but you're fired. And I said, what? And he goes, you're fired. Go get your stuff.
It's like the joke. It's like, what did the side guy say to get himself fired? Hey, I got an idea.
Yeah, exactly. So I found out really quickly that you don't give Rod ideas. But I mean, he's Rod Stewart. He can do whatever he wants, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you didn't last too long on that gig.
No. Weeks.
So now let's talk about the gear thing that you're doing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
When did that start? A couple years ago?
Yeah, it was kind of by accident. I have a relationship with this fellow named Cliff Coltrary, who owns Destroy All Guitars. And Cliff used to be a record executive at Sony, and he founded Relativity Records. And he was the guy that discovered Joe Satriani and Steve Vai and all this stuff, right? So Cliff ended up forming this company called Destroy All Guitars, which is a really super high-end boutique guitar and amp sales company. And he was on the cutting edge of that. He was doing that before all these other stores were doing it. He was like the guy, right?
Right.
So he and I kind of hit it off because I had a little store in Austin, a little online store called Guitar 25. Cliff saw me as, you know, up and coming competition.
So what was that? Tell me about that.
I guess that was like Guitar 25 was like, I had a relationship with Fred from Divided by 13 Amps and Two Rock Guys. And,
oh yeah. Divided by 13. Yeah. That's a good,
he's one of my favorite people and he and I are pals. And so I was retailing stuff like that and giving people advice on the phone about their rigs. Cause they knew I'd toured and I would, you know, so I'd give people advice. They'd buy things from me. So Cliff goes, well, hey, there's that guy in Austin that's starting to be kind of like a problem. So Cliff called me up and said, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't we work together and you can do like all of the like demos and scout for gear and I'll put up all the money, you know, cause I know you're limited on your budget and let's work together. You know? And I went, well, okay, why not? Let's do it. So part of my gig was demoing. So I had a crappy camera and, you know, a little Pro Tools rig and I was doing little demos by myself. Well, those started going over well. And then other guys started trying to do that for other stores and other manufacturers. Right. And some of them were doing a better job than we were. And I called Cliff and I said, look, we've got to step this up. So we got a real camera guy with multiple cameras, got a band, which no one else was doing.
Right.
And really started to work it. So within about 2.5 years, we had 1 million viewers on YouTube.
Yeah.
And it's increasing pretty rapidly.
And I'll be honest, you're great at it.
Oh, thanks.
You look good. You're very, you're not full of shit. You know, you do like that stuff.
Well, I do because I will tell you what most people don't know is we send stuff back. Like if a manufacturer sends me a guitar and I can't find a use for that guitar, if I went, well, what if I was up, you know, in this genre of music, would I like it better? I mean, I try to like really give it a once over, but there's been stuff that we've actually in good conscience had to send back, you know, just going, well, I'm sorry, we can't do this for you because we'd love to make money, but we also can't compromise what we're doing with the channel.
Yeah.
So everything on there is something that we've been behind.
And so how do people, they go to YouTube and just look you up, Lance Keltner?
Yeah.
Okay. And what about like a website and stuff? Do you,
you know, I got to be honest with you. It's like Facebook. I think LanceKeltner.com might even be down right now. You know, it's, I don't know.
I'd like to have a conversation with you. That's pretty serious.
Okay.
Some guys come in here and they're from Austin and they love Mexican food. And I'll say, so what are you, a Huero's guy or a Polvo's guy? But I noticed from following you on Facebook that you're a Matt's El Rancho guy.
I am a Matt's El Rancho guy.
I've never eaten there.
Oh, are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
Oh, my God. We have to go to Matt's.
Yeah, all right.
Well, I've got my own drink at Matt's.
There you go.
I don't know. Do you drink margaritas?
Yes, I will drink margaritas.
Then you may come with me to Matt's and I will have you. But my drink that I invented there is El Tesoro Añejo.
Uh-huh.
Grand Marnier.
Yeah.
Rocks, salt, real lime juice, and the tiniest bit of agave nectar done. And it's now most of the bartenders know it. So if people go and get, just ask for the one they do for me, they know how to do it.
It's not the Lance Keltner.
They just say, hey, make the one like you do for Lance. And they go, okay. Yeah. They just make it. And then, you know, the food's really good. If you've not had the food there, Matt's is killer. I got food poisoning at Paul Bowes. I don't eat there anymore.
I don't like it. I mean, I don't dislike it. I don't like it. Plus, I just get so drunk every time I'm there. I don't know what they put in the food.
I think they put Everclear or something in the margaritas because their margaritas are ridiculously strong.
They are really strong.
Mine's strong, but mine's strong from tequila and Grand Marnier, not from some, you know,
invisible drink called Everclear.
Right.
Waste you.
Yeah, so Guero's, you know, I live right behind Guero's, so I eat there some, but I'm still a Matt's guy.
Yeah.
I'll get in the car and go to Matt's and
stuff. One of the only guys that's like a Guero's guy is Charlie.
Is he the Guero's guy?
He is a Guero's guy.
You know what? I've always been a huge fan of his, and I hardly ever see him ever anymore. I mean, I know he's out. Is he working with Bob Dylan again? Yeah, he's awesome.
He is awesome.
He's one of the best musicians
ever.
And I'm a big Will fan, too, man.
Huge Will fan.
You know, it's like Rocks in My Pillow, still one of my
favorite
tunes.
Fuck yeah, man, me too. Yeah.
That's a great tune.
Teach the Teacher is another one of my favorite ones.
Yeah,
yeah. I love all these dudes. So what's next on Lance Keltner's plate?
Well, I've been asked to go back to Europe, but even when they ask you to go, it's, you know, almost a year off before the tour will happen. But
oh, wait, there is something I want to talk. Sorry, you are working on a project with Mickey Thomas from Jefferson Starship?
We may be. I've become friends with Frankie Sullivan from Survivor.
Is he?
Frankie's the guitar player that wrote to Eye of the Tiger and all those songs. And And Frankie, you know, is a sweetheart and called me up and said, you know, I want to do this thing with Mickey. And do you want to be involved? And it was really funny because we're talking about it. And I don't know if it'll happen or not, but it's like we were talking about it. And he said, you know, he had lost track of Mark Andes, right? He's like, you know, I wrote songs with Hart. He goes, it'd be really great if we got Mark Andes on bass. I wonder what happened to Mark Andes. I said, he lives like in Texas, like right around here. I've played with him.
Yeah.
And he goes, no way, call him and see if he'll be involved. And I called Andes up and said, hey, you know Frankie Sullivan, right? He's like, I love Frankie Sullivan. I was like, you want to do this project if it happens? And he's like, sure, sure. And so, you know, Frankie's like, who should we get on drums? And I threw Tommy's name in the hat because I said, look, Tommy's not in some other touring band where we have to outbid someone, you know, or something. He's just awesome and sings and plays great. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay, okay. So Frankie's coming down here, I think, at some point, and we're gonna write some and try to pull Mickey in on this thing. And
what is Mickey doing? What's he doing?
He's playing with Starship.
Oh, like his own version or something?
I don't know. I have no idea.
You know what I mean?
But if you go look him up on YouTube,
Frankie
said, go look up Mickey on YouTube.
Still singing great.
Oh my God. He sings better than he did.
That stuff was just so high. I can't like that. Jane.
I mean, he just kicks ass on that.
Unbelievable
singer.
It's like
at whatever age he is now. I mean, I'm sure he's in his 60s.
And plus, isn't he the guy that sang with the Elvin Bishop?
Fooled Around and Fell in Love.
Yeah, sang Fooled Around and Fell in Love.
And and I saw him do that on YouTube, and it was the video. It was like 2 months old.
Yeah.
And he's kicked butt on that. His voice hasn't changed a bit.
Yeah.
He's just ridiculous. It's like that guy that sang on all the Toto hits, Bobby Kimball.
Yeah, Bobby Kimball.
He's still got his voice.
You know Donnie Wynn?
I don't know Donnie.
That's a good guy.
Yeah?
He moved to L.A. with Bobby Kimball.
Did he?
That was one of the stories that he told me on this show.
Oh, wow.
Let me ask you, you're a guitar guy. You know guitar players.
Yeah.
You like guitar players. Mm-hmm. I'm going to name some guys and you tell me like, oh, yeah.
Okay.
And then like, oh, no.
Okay.
Joe Satriani.
Eh.
Okay. Yngwie.
Well, can we pause for a funny story real quick? Okay, Yngwie.
Dude.
I opened for Yngwie when he was with Alcatraz.
Right.
When he first came,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Jeff Tweedy, not the musician, but
the guy from here, yeah.
Right. Jeff's teching for me that night, and I'm sitting on a white 1968 Marshall cabinet, right? And Yngwie's up on stage by himself. He's been screaming at the road crew. We're at Sixth Street Live. He wants all his Marshalls on stage. And the guy's like, there's no room for all that. You've got four stacks. You don't need any more than that. It's a club.
They're empty.
He's screaming, they're full and all on.
Jesus.
He's louder than God. So he's sitting there by himself in a chair. All their crew has hearing protection on. And he's doing the whole Yngwie thing. He finally, he looks down at us and he walks down the stage, walks over and he goes, he says, so you're the one with the white 60s Marshall cabinet. I went, yeah, I'm Lance. He goes, yes. He says, I have 16 Marshall cabinets. I went, great, that's cool. And he goes, I'm Yngwie. And I went, oh, hi, Yngwie, this is Jeff, and I'm Lance. And he goes, no, I'm Yngwie. You have read about me in the magazines. So to this.
That's what I think he would be like.
So to this day.
Yeah.
The few times I get to talk to Jeff Tweedy, if he calls me, it could be like any time, years from that point to now, Jeff will call and go, Lance, I'll go, yeah, it's Jeff Tweedy. He goes, you've read about me in the magazines. So anyway, go ahead. But yeah,
okay.
Yngwie, you know, he's good at what he does, but you know.
Jeff Beck.
I love Jeff Beck.
Okay.
Jeff Beck's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was very privileged to get, through Carmine Rojas, to get to meet Jeff Beck one time, and
he seems like a cool guy.
Oh, he is the coolest guy.
Yeah.
I tried to talk to him about all his guitar stuff, and he was like, oh, man, no, that's all. I don't even really care about guitars. He goes, I'm into hot rods. He starts telling me about his garage and his lift and all the stuff he does at home. And, you know.
Yeah.
And apparently he's so self-effacing. In his neighborhood, he told me, the old ladies there bring their cars to him for service. and they don't know he's Jeff Beck, the famous guitarist. Right. They know he's that Jeff fellow with the garage at his house. He's a nice young man.
That is awesome.
Yeah, so he's a sweetheart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
Who else? Let me think of someone else. Well, obviously you like Clapton.
No.
At some point.
No.
No.
And I tell you, there's a reason.
Okay.
In high school, in Lawton, Oklahoma, Guitar Player magazine comes out 1 month. Clapton's standing there looking cool with a Explorer on, and a wall of Music Man amps.
Okay.
So I go down to the music shop and I go, "What's this? What's this?"
Yeah.
What the things Clapton's endorsing now, and went, if Clapton quit playing Marshall to play these, they've got to be amazing.
Yeah.
Sell my 68 Marshall, order me one of these things. I've always wanted to slap him ever since then.
Yeah.
Because I got the Music Man, and it was like, this is like a weird, ugly sounding Fender twin.
Yeah.
Ooh, you know.
What about the skunk?
Oh, he's awesome. When did you get to hang
I was
out
in
with?
This band Endosheen, and he loved Endosheen.
Yeah.
And I mean, he really did. He really loved those guys. So he would pop up when we were he played with us at ACL.
He's awesome.
And then he played with us like in Washington. I ended up hanging out all day with him. I did not let him leave my side. He was willing to tell stories, and sure. I was like fucking willing to listen. Because those guys in Endosheen, they didn't know. They didn't care. Like, I knew his line when the Doobie Brothers were on What's Happening.
Right.
Like, I was like, I remember seeing. He's like, you remember what Rerun said when I answered the phone? And I said, yes. He said, which Doobie you be? And he was like, whoa.
You know right. the stuff.
You
right?
win.
Right, yeah. right.
So he just told me. So, and then, plus, he's a weird, like...
gun guy
too. Not it's not just a gun guy. I mean, he's a counterterrorism expert who lives in a bunker half a mile under the ground in Afghanistan 6 months out of the year.
Wow.
yeah.
that's
and then he comes and jams with Endosheen.
That's the real deal.
Yeah.
Does he still do Doobie Brothers stuff or no?
I don't think so.
No,
he doesn't care about bands and stuff. He likes being a cop, and he likes playing guitar with people and being
cool.
free. Yeah, he's very cool.
I've always thought he was fantastic.
What about a weird guy like Thurston Moore? Where are you with a Sonic Youth? Or
yeah, you know, it's, I never really guys? never got into that guy.
Sure.
I liked Billy from
Smashing Pumpkins.
Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was really cool. Really, really interesting tones and stuff.
That's interesting that that's yours, because he comes from... to me, they were... Did you ever listen to a band called My Bloody Valentine at all? There was a lot that they took from them,
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah.
A weird thing. What else?
I don't know. What else you got?
I don't know.
Okay.
I like talking to you, though.
Yeah, you too, man.
And we'll have to go to Matt's El Rancho.
Please. Yeah. You can call... You have my number. Let's, you know... Because I'm at Matt's probably four times a week. Three, four times
That's
a week.
What it seems like from Facebook. It seems like you also go to Mexico a lot.
I try.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, years ago when the border towns were safer.
Yeah.
My band would go down there a lot. In fact, a lot of the songs, you know, we wrote were based on crazy border town stories and things, you know. So, I mean, I always used to say when the going gets tough, the tough go to Mexico.
Yeah. That's
you
a good
know,
one.
We had fun, you know, and I have a phrase I'm putting on the neck of a guitar that I think you'll appreciate too. Anything excellent in or near Mexico is mexcellent.
Yeah, that's great. Mexcellent.
Yes. Mexcellent. Oh, that's mexcellent.
Yeah, that is mexcellent.
Yeah.
I think that my cousin Emily says that to our friend, Mexican friend Joe.
Oh, wow.
I think she, whenever he says something to her, she goes, oh, mexcellent.
Really?
But she means it in a racist way.
Really?
But we're Cuban, so it's just kind of like a, you know, an inner
yes.
brown man.
Well, when did your family come from Cuba?
60.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, when Castro got there.
Yeah, it's like, bye.
Yeah, I was the first guy born here.
Wow. And in Florida, or?
In Florida, Miami, yeah.
Yep.
That's where I'm.
That's where everybody goes to first,
That's
I guess.
That's where they go. My family went there, and then they went to Wichita Falls. I can't even imagine what that must have been like for them.
So you lived in Wichita Falls?
No, it was before I was born.
Oh, wow. See, because my mother's family's from Iowa Park, which is right next to...
Yeah, that's what you were saying.
Yeah.
But at least if you grew up here, like coming from Havana to Miami to Wichita Falls would be pretty tough.
That'd be bizarre. It'd be culture shock.
I haven't been to Wichita Falls in a long time. It's still.
I have no. I haven't been there either. I mean, I you know, many of us that were in Lawton, Oklahoma, just don't go anywhere near there. You know, not Wichita Falls is almost too close to Lawton.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
Yeah.
I mean. To give you a Lawton story, right? I hadn't been there in years, and I was the only guy from Lawton besides the band Two Guns that ever had a record deal.
Right.
So I go back there, and it's, you know, it's strange, you know, because I'm the only guy that had a record deal from there besides us. And there was one gay guy in our high school, and he was the coolest guy.
Right.
And he was brave enough to, like, have a 60s Mustang that was painted pink. And he would wear, like, girls' shirts. And, I mean, he just was, go for it. I mean, if you want to beat me up for being gay, you'd beat me up for being gay.
Yeah.
And I guess about 8 or 10 years ago, before my mom died, maybe it was 10 years ago, I went back there and with a friend, and I'm sitting there with Randy, the one gay guy from high school.
Yeah.
We're sitting at a club, and this girl who was like the popular girl in high school when we were there,
yeah,
came up and whispered in my ear. She said, "You know, you're sitting at the table with that fag."
Oh.
And I looked around and I went, "What?" And she goes, "People are going to talk bad about you. They're going to think you're a fag too." And I'm thinking, what era did I just step into?
That's weird that people still think like that, isn't it?
Right.
That's just freaky.
Right.
My dad's kind of like that.
Yeah, is he?
Yeah. Yeah, he's got gay sisters.
He doesn't.
It's, yeah.
Well, you know, when my dad turned his thing around.
Yeah.
And this is no longer kind of a national security thing, but my godparents were the people that my mother and father's best friend, we lived in Germany.
Yeah.
And they made them my godparents. In case anything happened to them, they would raise me, right? So this guy was head of all the nuclear silos in Germany. He was the guy.
Yeah.
Trusted. Big time trusted.
The ones pointed to the east, right?
The ones pointed at Russia.
Okay.
Right. So years later, he came out as gay and left his wife and lived the life he wanted to live, right? Completely changed my dad forever.
That's good, man.
I mean, my dad after that said, if John Raines is a gay person,
then they're cool.
Then I can't judge people by their sexual preference because he's a good man.
Yeah.
You know. And so, you know, it's weird to go two places where the primary sort of vibe is still a little backwards.
Yeah, it's kind of freaky to think like that, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, you just want to sit them all down at Matt's and get them a margarita and go, look, talk about stuff. You might find that you're not that different. So
let's, I want to wrap this up on a good note, okay?
Sure, yeah.
Are you happy you didn't become an airborne ranger?
My guess is the era that I was talking about, I might not be sitting here if I'd become an airborne ranger, you know? So I would have liked to have...
Have you ever parachuted?
I haven't.
Okay.
And I still want to do it. I still may do it.
Yeah.
I thought about it a few times over the years, and I kind of thought, wow, you know, it's weird. I would have been like retired with a full retirement pay at like 35. And now I'm about to be 50 New Year's Eve, and I'm a musician, and I'm like, there is no such thing as retirement. It's like, you just got to keep doing what you do, and you know.
But that makes you happy, right? You see a guy like Mac, and you go like, shit.
Yeah.
That guy.
Mac's one of my favorite guys.
Yeah.
I mean, he was when Rod canned me.
He was.
The first call I got when I got back to Austin was from Mac.
Yeah.
And the phone rings at my little studio. And I hear this crazy laughter. And I went, what? Who is this? And he goes, that's his Mac. And I'm like, what's going on? And he goes, oh, you're in a very special club, mate. he goes, you're in that club of people who are hated by Rod Stewart. He goes, Jeff Beck's in the club. Lots of great people. Hey, don't worry about it.
Well, there's something beautiful about, he's a good example because it's a guy that, you know, you see 1 week being inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Playing, you know, to everyone on HBO or whatever, and the next week he's playing for no cover at the Lucky Lounge
because he loves to play,
and he's playing the exact same way with the exact same amount of enthusiasm. He's not like, oh, this is a free show. It's not like Jan Wenner's not here.
No, so
he loves it.
He's,
and that's something that I look that like, you know, as I get older, I you know, there are days that I wake up and I'm like, seriously, what the fuck am I doing? Like, you know,
right.
What am I fucking retarded? But
all of us were slightly out there to want to do this for a living at all. But
sure.
But you're right. If you look at somebody like Mac and you go, here's somebody that loves what he does and he's so good at what he does and he's never varied from what he did.
No, and that's why he's always working too. That's why people still go see him because he really is.
That.
In the moment
of
playing and not wishing he was somewhere else. He's just always exactly in that moment.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. And he's, you know, I'm happy to know him because he is just one of the coolest people.
Yeah.
You know, he's great. And, you know, he and Andy and I are all pals. And, you know, Andy Johns is, you know, just a nutcase too. And he still does the exact same thing he did in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know,
Tommy Taylor too. You know, you see a guy like that. I mean... Tommy's a little older. Is he older than you?
Yeah.
I don't even know how old he is.
Yeah, he's older than me. I don't know how much older. I'm almost 50, I think. Tommy's probably a good, you know, 6 or 7, 8 years older than I am, maybe. Mm-hmm. You and Eric is as well, I think.
And do you know him?
Eric Johnson?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're friends.
You guys buddies?
We've been
You
friends.
Think he would do something like this?
Yeah.
If I went to him?
Yeah. I'll ask him.
Yeah?
Yeah, I bet he would. He's a sweetheart. You'd love him.
I've been around him before, and he's really nice.
You know what's funny, too, about Eric that a lot of people don't get, because guitar players are so intimidated, usually, they don't say much to him.
Right.
Is he's got a tremendous sense of humor.
Yeah.
He's really down to earth, and he's really, really funny, and he does not take himself seriously at all. He's really funny. It's like he... Like one time, I remember years ago, we were at Vince Mariani's house, you know, and Vince and Eric had played together for years when they were younger. Uh-huh. And I think Eric had just won best overall guitar player for like the fifth time in a row in Guitar Player magazine, right? So Eric's writing this thing up, and he's like kind of smiling and giggling. We're like, what's going on? What's going on? And he goes, here's what I'm going to do. He goes, I'm going to send him a picture of me in a pair of overalls. And he writes this little note that says something to the effect, I can't remember, it's been so many years ago, but something to the effect of I want to thank the readers and staff of Guitar Player magazine for naming me best overall guitarist for the fifth year in a row. Yeah, I pride myself on being a snappy dresser. You know, kind
of. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah,
you have a great sense of humor and a great perspective, and you tell great stories.
Thanks.
Let's do it again.
Yeah, love to.
Just keep on doing this every few months.
Okay. Good to see you.
Lance Keltner, thank you.
Thanks, man. Yes, man. I'm on the
streets of New Orleans. All right. It's my friend Lance Keltner. That was a great time. I'm glad that he came over and we got to do that. He's a fucking funny guy. Good stories, great musician. If you're interested in high-end gear, man, look up those YouTube videos, man. He's got a lot of really great stuff. I'm a huge fan of those Troussard guitars because they're fucking awesome. Anyway, hey, everyone, be sure that you subscribe to us on iTunes. And when you do, rate us and leave us a comment. It helps us on our ratings on iTunes. And if you want to, follow me on Twitter. I tweet a lot. And also, I'm out there. How did I get here? Facebook page. Like it. All right? Thank you so much again for listening. I hope everyone's having a great last week before Christmas. Here's a little bit more Lance Keltner. Let's get down.
Child, it's Friday night, me and the